Well, I want to introduce you to a product I literally love. It's Public Rec. It's an all-purpose pant. I got tired of wearing sweats during the pandemic. In fact, it depressed me to wear sweats. And I didn't want to wear jeans because they were – because I was home. I didn't want to wear them. And then I was introduced to Public Rec. Now, they are fitted perfectly. The length can be too long or too short in most of these sort of sweatpants, right? No, the waist and the length is fitted to you. Here's what I love, I think, most. Well, I love this stretchy material. It's unbelievable. But secondly, somebody thought of everything. Somebody literally put these pants on and lounged around and, by the way, went out in the world and said, how should we engineer these things? Pockets are deep. Pockets have zippers. There's a wallet pocket in the back that is deep and the wallet never falls out. They are durable. You can literally lie in these things feeling like you're in pajamas and jump up and go out and engage in the world as though you're wearing slacks. That, I swear to you, that is how I wear these Public Rec pants. They have what they call their all-day, everyday pant. That's what they are. They are stylish, and these are top in my rotation. Good for lounging at home, and the all-day, everyday pant comes in a waist and seam sizing, so they fit tall, short, in between, whatever it is. And it's breathable. It's warm, but it's breathable, so it's not too hot. So, again, I'm a huge fan of this product. I wear them all the time, and they come in great colors. I thankfully have several colors, so I put them in rotation. And a lot of my pants are getting pushed to the back of the closet. Public Rec rarely discounts, but right now they have an exclusive offer just for the Dr. Drew listeners. Go to Public Rec, public, like out public, Rec, R-E-C. So it's PublicRec.com/Drew, not Dr. Drew, just Drew. And then use the promo code Drew to receive 10% off. Well worth it. Public Rec, R-E-C, PublicRec.com/Drew, promo code Drew for 10% off. Hey, everybody. Welcome to Dr. Drew Podcast. Of course, keep supporting those guys that let us keep doing this podcast. We appreciate it very, very much. And, of course, Master Corolla does as well. And head over to drdrew.com. Check out Your Mom's House. I've got After Dark there, and we do a stream every day. If you sign up at drdrew.tv or go to Facebook/Dr. Drew or YouTube Dr. Drew, you'll find those streams there on a daily basis. And we have lots of interesting people. Much like today's guest, James Todaro. The website is medicineuncensored.com. You can follow Dr. Todaro on Twitter at James Todaro, T-O-D-A-R-O-M-D. And we're going to talk a little COVID, right, sir?
That's correct.
So you've gotten involved. Tell me how you got involved in this. Are you at Columbia still? Are you out in New York?
No, I'm actually in Michigan now.
Okay. And obviously the pandemic hit and you got involved in publishing some early papers. Tell me about how you got there.
Sure. Yeah. So really since January, it looked like COVID-19 was going to have an effect on kind of the whole global ecosystem.
Yeah.
And so I was watching it closely starting then, but it wasn't until about March that I became much more actively involved in the pandemic and publishing papers. And it really started with the first paper I co-authored, which was proposing chloroquine or its closely related compound hydroxychloroquine as a potential therapeutic candidate for COVID-19.
I have lots of questions for us as we go here. Did you focus in on that because of the early data on the SARS-1 papers and the CD's enthusiasm for its antiviral properties back then?
It was a combination of things. And so, so it was that 2005 paper, which showed that it was potentially effective, at least in vitro, against SARS-CoV-1. And then we're seeing data coming out of South Korea and China, where hydroxychloroquine is being used in their treatment guidelines over there. And then we're also in contact saw some results coming from the south of France. This was, of course, before Dr. Raoul published his paper on hydroxychloroquine. But so the combination of the in vitro evidence, my co-author was pretty familiar with the antiviral properties of hydroxychloroquine.
Which are extensive. There's multiple mechanisms and it's well described, particularly with coronaviruses, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So.
And so what was, I guess, shocking to me, the reason we even published that paper is, we were seeing this evidence, yet it wasn't being discussed anywhere. It wasn't being investigated by the World Health Organization, the CDC, the FDA. Wasn't discussed on mainstream media at all. And so we thought that information needed to get out there. And so we published that just as a Google document because we wanted to get it out there to the public as quickly as possible and not wait for maybe a lengthy peer review process. And then once that paper was published, it it went viral after Elon Musk tweeted it out. And then just a few short days later, the president was talking about hydroxychloroquine in a press conference.
Right. And then suddenly it became a dangerous, horrible. I've been prescribing Plaquenil for 35 years, which is hydroxychloroquine.
Oh my gosh!
Not only have I never seen a side effect. We'd always tell them, and this is a medicine they would take daily for years. These rheumatology patients. And we'd always say, hey, at a year, see the ophthalmologist. You can get some retinal deposits or maybe some corneal deposits or retinal processes, but never saw anything ever, ever. And now I was doing my continuing medical education on rheumatology, and I came upon – Plaquenil is obviously recommended everywhere for all sorts of rheumatic diseases. But they focused in on pregnancy and said, oh, no, if you have a lupus patient on Plaquenil, don't even consider taking her off. Keep her on the Plaquenil through the pregnancy. It's harmless. Yeah, I can't say that about any other medication.
Right. And there's studies that show that even hydroxychloroquine, even combined with azithromycin, didn't show any increased mortality in a large cohort of pregnant patients.
And chloroquine I used to prescribe all the time for malaria. It's available over-the-counter in malaria-ridden countries. How in the world did our profession fall victim to politics? It's people who – literally talk show hosts who just learned how to pronounce hydroxychloroquine 2 weeks ago have strong opinions about whatever should be prescribed. That is insane. That's a certain kind of insane.
You're giving them too much credit. Most of them can't actually even pronounce it correctly.
Right. It's true. Right. It's true. So what do we do? This is a horror story I never saw coming.
There's just so many elements of this regarding hydroxychloroquine, fatality rates, reopening up, that there's just a tremendous amount of misinformation out there, which is actually why I just continue to be involved in investigative research on this pandemic. And when you mentioned hydroxychloroquine for the eye problems, that's one of the main side effects. And I'm an ophthalmologist by training, so I was pretty familiar with hydroxychloroquine before this pandemic. And, hydroxychloroquine was first branded as dangerous, and if you really look at when we first put out the paper, because people were saying, "Oh, it'll cause you to go blind," right. And I was like, "Whoa, whoa, whoa! We're talking about after about 5 years of daily use in relatively high doses, you're at a slightly increased risk of these kind of retinal deposits that can cause some blindness."
Yeah,
certainly not in a short treatment course.
Yeah,
and then it kind of segued into, "Oh, well, it's dangerous for the heart." And that's kind of where we've been left for a long time. And of course, there's really not any good data that shows increased mortality or lethal cardiac arrhythmias with hydroxychloroquine. Yet that's the narrative used by a lot of the governments, Dr.
Bizarre.
Fauci.
It's bizarre. Bizarre.
Labeling it as dangerous. I'm sure you've talked about, created basically a fraudulent study to try to show that it was dangerous because it can actually find good.
Right, this was the Lancet study. This is the Lancet study that had to be retracted, which never happens. That's how fraudulent it was. So here's my confusion. So we have some good data. I wouldn't even say good because none of them included zinc. But I personally believe zinc is an important cofactor in the efficacy of the drug. But okay. So you've got some decent studies on hospitalized patients. Never really intended for hospitalized patients, but okay. Some decent studies on prophylaxis without zinc, but okay. I kind of thought that might happen. Why aren't there studies on early COVID, which is where it's intended to be used with
that
zinc? With zinc, by the way.
That's the biggest question. So that's something. So if you look back through my Twitter feed and through Dr. Raul and Dr. Zelenko, who are did a lot of research on this and treating patients with hydroxychloroquine. We've all been saying the same thing. Really, this needs to be used very early, before you have cytokine storm, before you have the hyperinflammatory phase of COVID-19.
Yeah.
And yet, all these massive studies focus on patients that are, a large percent of them are already in the ICU, intubated, where viral replication is maybe not really the most important factor anymore,
right.
Where hydroxychloroquine is probably most effective.
That's
and
right.
So, and if you look at these meta-analysis studies and stuff, they mainly are just kind of focused on that late stage of disease where, most of us would say it was minimally or not really, didn't really stand much of a chance of being effective.
We didn't intend for it to be used then. It's intended to be used like in the first 3 days of fever or cough or early when viral replication is really the issue. And again, exactly. And with zinc, and the azithromycin, I don't quite get that, but okay. You know, that's neither here nor there.
So a couple of comments on it. So azithromycin, there's some small evidence that might have some antiviral effects in epithelial cells, but mm-hmm. it seems like it's really more to me, maybe potentially preventing a bacterial superinfection or something.
Or whatever, yeah.
Maybe in hospitalized patients. So that, I don't know. I know zinc. I think even Dr. Raul, because he didn't use zinc in his initial studies. I think he actually just came out with a paper or announcement saying that he agrees as well that zinc is probably a pretty important cofactor.
How about quercetin? Are you involved in all that stuff?
I've heard some good things about it. I, honestly haven't taken a deep dive into it, so I'm not 100% sure how sound the data is on it. So I just mainly in data driven.
Yeah.
And so that I just haven't seen the data.
So I will tell you, I take it. My wife takes it with zinc. There is not sufficient data for me to recommend it to other people.
Right. That was kind of where I my investigation stuff.
Yeah.
When you mentioned the prophylaxis studies on hydroxychloroquine, I don't know if you've discussed on the show or not the big one that people were talking about is the one that was done in the University of Minnesota that was published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And that was kind of one of the studies that Dr. Fauci kind of alluded to when he said, look, it doesn't work in late stage of the disease and it doesn't work for prophylaxis. But what many people don't realize is that University of Minnesota study was essentially an anonymous online survey.
What?
It was actually done where they recruited patients online. You signed up and they were never seen by a physician. Most of the patients were actually didn't even have tests for SARS-CoV-2. So they weren't even tested. And so basically diagnosing those patients with COVID-19 came from just a questionnaire. So basically the quality of those diagnoses was about similar to like a WebMD diagnosis. That's what they were using. And so, and then even then, they used it in fairly healthy patients. So of course the mortality was very low already. But if you take it, the combination of the fact that there was a lower mortality, even though it wasn't significant, it was a small pool of patients. And then a lot of those patients probably didn't even actually truly have COVID-19. You could kind of see how, the benefit of hydroxychloroquine might not kind of fully be exposed in those studies. And that goes with their second study, which was then published in the Annals of Internal Medicine, which showed early use shortly after contracting the disease. And it was the same problem. I think only about 33% of patients actually tested positive for SARS-CoV-2. And actually, a number of the patients are included tested negative for it, but they included them anyway. So, the studies on prophylaxis use are not robust by any means. And I don't really think that they're sound enough to dismiss hydroxychloroquine as effective
interesting.
In early disease.
Very, very interesting. So you still are holding out on prophylaxis, which it seems I figured there had to be more studies that were – I didn't realize it was a questionnaire. That's insane. Okay. So you and I are exactly in alignment. And by the way, I have prescribed it in COVID many times. And only one patient that I have treated got into real trouble. And that patient unfortunately checked every box for risk factors of COVID storm, of a cytokine storm, including antiphospholipid syndrome. And,
gotcha. Wow. Yeah,
and I'm telling you, the storm developed like in 3 days. It was fast. Boom. It was just on.
Wow.
Terrible. So, okay. So you were going to talk about fatality figures as well.
Yeah, so that's another thing that so we came out with a paper. So I co-authored a paper with a couple others, as well as Dr. Zelenko, back in April when we first were starting to see some of these serology studies. And if you remember, the mainstream media immediately attacked them, saying that they weren't good studies, that they the antibody tests weren't that great, and that the actual mortality rate is higher. It's not the infectious mortality rate is not low. But we came out with a paper that said, look, it looks like the infection fatality rate across all ages is roughly about 0.2%.
Okay, hold on. So let's emphasize that. So this is from 0 to 85, essentially. The overall fatality rate is 0.2%, right?
That's correct.
Do you break it down by age group at all, or do you?
I do. I don't have the chart in front of me, but in that paper, shortly after that published paper, I added basically an addendum, which was a chart breaking it down into certain age groups, the infection fatality rate, which obviously most of those deaths, the highest infection fatality rate is those over, roughly 65 years of age, whereas in the lower age groups, it's incredibly zero. Small.
It's a flu. It's a flu in the younger age group. And by the way, not as bad, not nearly as bad in younger people as H1N1.
Absolutely. Fewer deaths, right. And fewer deaths even for the normal flu, non-H1N1 flu.
Right.
In kids and, those under five.
Right. So flu A, influenza A, H1N1, way worse for a younger person. Not way worse. Worse absolutely. For a younger person. H1N1 absolutely. Definitely way worse. I had H1N1, almost died. It was horrific. And I was 50
one of my
at the time.
One of my great friends, his fiance actually had it. She was a healthy, athletic 20-year-old, developed H1N1, actually had to go on ECMO.
Oh,
it was so bad.
Jesus.
And fortunately, so basically ECMO for your listeners is like a machine that replaces
her lungs failed. Her lungs completely failed, even on a ventilator. And here's the deal. This is what I keep saying. So that was 2009. We had that pandemic. And you don't even know it happened. No one knows it happened. How do we go from an epidemic, the pandemic that was killing 20 to 40-year-olds pretty routinely, not as bad, but pretty routinely, to true – this is a different pandemic. It's different. It's more infectious. It's more dangerous for older people. It's got a higher fatality rate probably than H1N1. But how do we go from not knowing it's happening – to destroying our lives in an attempt to avoid this flu? How did that happen?
It's unbelievable. So I think that there's a combination of political and pharmaceutical interests.
Zelenko keeps pointing at the pharmaceuticals. They're an easy target. But go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah. Everyone kind of knows the political interests on it. With one of the most controversial U.S. elections in history coming up.
It feels even more subtle than that, though. It's almost like a misunderstanding. First of all, these so-called political leaders have never made medical decisions before, and I would say most of the public health officials seem to have never made medical decisions before the way they're behaving, most of them, and they don't understand risk reward at all, and they seem to have a misconception of what their job is as a governor, as a mayor. That's not their job.
I mean, I don't know if ever in history they've directly infringed on a doctor-patient relationship like they have with hydroxychloroquine, which is an FDA-approved medication for the past 65 years. That's always been a decision.
There are 1,000 pills, at least 1,000. Probably at least 1,000 days out there of pills that I have prescribed with hydroxychloroquine, at least. I'm sure you have something to say about quarantine, this whole thing of quarantining healthy people.
Yeah, it's very odd. We kind of took this approach where we just want to treat everyone equally and have everyone under the same maybe punishment or same strict protocols as – whether you're a healthy 20-year-old or whether you're an 85-year-old person with comorbidities, which is just really ridiculous. It's not how you go about this, and we've already seen the ramifications of that.
That is literally the same as saying, I've got to take this 14-year-old and assess him for cardiac risk and make sure he doesn't have a heart attack, much the way I would a 75-year-old smoker, because there's no difference.
Yep.
Same thing. Yep. Same thing.
Yep. Yep. And it's really sad because we, the ramifications, while we're focusing on schools and young people, we totally ignore the nursing homes. And we all know that those are the people that really suffered the most, is the vulnerable who didn't really even have, patient advocates with them and ended up passing away alone. And it's absolutely tragic what happened to them. And not just the U.S., but even countries around the world.
I want to go back on to the fatality rate, but I want to finish this conversation about the quarantine. Never in history, except briefly in Venice during the Black Plague, were healthy people quarantined. And when it was done historically, it was a huge mistake. Was it a huge mistake this time? And by the way, this particular episode, for people who don't know, was invented by a 14-year-old high school student. Do you know this, Gary? You've heard me say it before, yes? Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. 14-year-old high school student came up with the idea of quarantining to prevent school-wide outbreaks of influenza, a very different disease transmitted very differently. Her father was a computer programmer at Los Alamos, a modeling scientist, built a model to say, hey, we ought to have larger quarantines of regions if we have a pandemic. That became policy in the Bush administration, never applied, and now magically applied as though it's sort of standard fare.
Yeah, it's you know, obviously I don't agree with that approach. I think that you know, hopefully we'll see the kind of truth of the data, and we'll probably recognize that it was not the right approach.
Well, let's go back to my original statement that it made things worse. Did it make things worse?
In my opinion, yes.
Yeah. It may be strictly in terms of COVID or in terms of the overall health cost?
Well, certainly the overall health cost.
Or both,
I mean,
yeah.
We're already, you know, much more, you know, use of drugs, suicides, psychological health of,
oh, it's crazy.
Of people overall.
It's kids, crazy.
We don't even know the ramifications of this that will happen.
So how about the students? The kids were told, you know, you go outside, your parents are going to die. You can't go to school. I mean, to tell it to an 8-year-old for 6 months, who knows what the impact of that's going to be?
Yeah, and just even the socialization side of things, you know, you're now worried you can't get too close to your friends. You have to stay away from their parents. And it's a mess.
It's a mess. And what – do you have any opinion what we should be doing?
I think the same opinion I had back in April, which was protect the vulnerable.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, you know, which I'm going to talk about a little bit later, but I think many parts of the country – have already, you know, reached something of an effective herd immunity threshold where they're probably safe opening up and won't see a second wave of deaths. And those are particularly for the hardest hit areas of the country. So I think that schools can open up there for sure. And, you know, we should, focus on protecting nursing homes, maybe testing for our healthcare workers in those homes and those patients.
Well, let's dig into testing a little bit. I mean, the PCR we're using is so terrific, so accurate. Well, not accurate. So good at picking up viral particles, RNA particles. That are we testing for COVID or just viral RNA in the environment? Because they don't distinguish between cases, meaning COVID sick, and virus present.
Absolutely. So that's something that I had been saying. I said that. So I did this, which again, I'm talking about a little bit, this thread on T-cell immunity. And one of the – and a vaccine scientist, immunologist, basically attacked me and said, well, we're seeing rises in a number of cases and, you know, where it shows live virus. And I was like, well, just because it's a PCR test, that doesn't mean that you have a live infectious virus. And he was like, that's not true, blah, blah, blah. And he labeled all his credentials again. And now even New York Times, BBC, and we're seeing many scientists come out saying, hey, look, actually those PCR tests, you know, up to 70 to 90% of those people that test positive probably don't have an infectious live virus.
They're certainly not sick. And then what we don't know, though, is whether they're contagious. That's a more difficult question, right?
Well, I think that's what a lot of those immunologists and scientists were discussing that, though, where they, you know, based on the number of cycles that the PCR has to go through to detect this virus, that probably at somewhere between 30, you know,
40.
Cycles.
40.
Right. They do 40.
Yeah.
But they're saying that anything after about maybe 25 to 30 cycles, that's probably either way too low to be infectious, or it might not even be kind of an active virus that could be infectious. Might be fragments.
So are they reporting what cycle they're detecting?
No, that's a problem. Is it just across the board? You get a test back, says positive or negative. You don't know whether it took 40 cycles to detect a tiny fragment of the viral RNA or whether it was, you know, 10 cycles, which means you have probably a lot of the virus.
They may find they're just picking it up.
An incredibly important distinction in which they're kind of talking about how in future testing, that should be an included parameter in that, or they should just decrease the number of cycles for the PCR test, or maybe it is more like 28 cycles.
And you, what's that, Gary?
Can you guys dumb down the cycle thing a little bit and explain it to me?
So, you want to do it?
Sure. So the way PCR works is it's a way.
So hold on a second. Let's go all the way. It's polymerase chain reaction. Okay.
Okay.
Chain reaction. So it's a lab technique where you take a certain sequence of, say, DNA or RNA, and you basically amplify it. So you keep making copies of it.
You make a copy. You make a copy, and then you amplify those copies.
Right. So as you can see, if you each time you make a copy, you kind of have an exponential reproduction of the sample. And so, you know, that's how you're able to take a, you know, a single fragment and then amplify it enough where you can then detect it in a test and show, okay, it's present. And so each cycle you do that, it kind of exponentially amplifies the number of those fragments.
So remember, RNA or DNA is just a piece of it's a sequence of ribonucleic acids with a code, right? That the genetic code, and RNA has a code too, and they just take the complementary fragment, because you can put ribonucleic acids bind with other ribonucleic acids, and you bring out the same code and then amplify that code thousands of times.
So basically, the point that you guys are getting at is that when you do that, you could be – you're going to get a reporting that says positive when it's such a minute thing at the original level before you've exponentially
– the way I think of it is there's so much viral RNA in the environment now that you could pick it up all kinds of – it could be sitting in my nose but not making me sick. It could be fragments. It could be all kinds of things. And we're picking all that up now because our testing is so good. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Am I saying that right, James?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep.
So our testing is ultimately given
too good.
And given what some of the governors, I'm thinking of my own state of California, are putting the numbers at, it's going to be impossible for us to go.
We're never getting out of this. The way Newsom has set up this color scale,
less than one.
As soon as it came out, I said impossible, impossible. Impossible that we'll ever get out of this. Because think about it just this way: not everyone's going to get the vaccine. So all that – there's going to be viral particles around quite a bit, and people that aren't vaccinated or even people who are immune may carry it. It's going to be all over the place. And this idea of 1 per 100,000 is the threshold before we can open again is a kind of insanity that makes me furious. It's a weird –
it's unrealistic.
It's ridiculous. Unrealistic. It's like, who made that rule? Not a biologist. I guarantee you that.
Thank you. I'm sorry to interrupt.
Oh, my God. I'm glad you brought that up, because I'm exorcised about that. I don't know what it's like in Michigan, but, man, in California, this is concentration camp time. I mean, it really is just –
not as bad as California, but it's not great.
This is insanity, these people. So you mentioned something about T-cell function. Was there a story you wanted to tell there?
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess bring up Gary's comment to kind of take a step back and kind of make that accessible for our listeners. So, you know, your immune system really consists of two parts. You have the innate, which is the non-specific immune system, which kind of just attacks general pathogens in your body. And then you have something called the adaptive immune system, which is the more specific one and the part of your immune system that can adapt to certain pathogens or viruses that it's exposed to. So that's how you kind of develop immunity over time to certain viruses and colds. And so there is really two major cells as part of this adaptive immune system. There's B cells, which make antibodies, which a lot of people are familiar with the role of antibodies in protection against viruses. But then there's also something called T cells, which can also remember and learn specific diseases and viruses and learn to attack infected cells.
So let's amplify that. So T cells, to some extent, direct B cells. And if they see a cell that got a virus, they can go kill that cell before it's able to reproduce the virus and infect the person.
Exactly.
Yeah. Go ahead, keep going.
Yep. And so there's been a growing amount of research over the last 2 months, which I don't think has been focused on by mainstream media nearly as much as it should. And they seem to focus it mainly from a vaccine perspective as opposed to a natural immunity perspective.
Right.
But what research has shown, and there's a number of studies, it's not just one study, we're talking about multiple studies now, where they took blood samples from pre-pandemic, so from 2019, took those blood samples, exposed them to SARS-CoV-2, so the novel coronavirus. And what they found is, and the numbers varied a little bit, but about 50% of those blood samples had T cells that specifically recognized SARS-CoV-2.
Would you do me a favor, and could you, if you have those papers in one place, just send them to Gary so we can forward them to me? I'd love to read them.
Yes, I can definitely do that.
And one of the theories I had heard is that coronaviruses are everywhere. They're the things that cause colds. And this may be some remnant of previous exposure to some other coronavirus. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So that was even hypothesized by a number of the researchers in those papers, where there's four coronaviruses that make up a large part of the common cold. And so the thinking is that they share a lot of similarities. Even though this is called the novel coronavirus, it's still a coronavirus and has a lot of similar structures as the coronaviruses that make up the common cold. And so the thinking is that in probably about 50% of people who were exposed to the common cold coronaviruses developed this degree of T cell immunity to be able to cross-react with the novel coronavirus. And so what this means is this is kind of a big deal because it changes the idea of, you know, the path of this disease from an epidemiological standpoint, as well as, you know, infectious disease prediction, because it was originally thought that, you know, 60 to 70% of people had to get infected with SARS-CoV-2 to reach this herd immunity threshold because we had no immunity, zero immunity to this novel coronavirus. But that's most likely not the case. And that's kind of, we're not really seeing that in city after city, region after region around the world. We're not seeing it hit about 60 to 70% infected based on serology testing, at least. Instead, what we're seeing is it hits about 20% infected, and then cases begin to decline, deaths begin to decline, and then we really don't see a second wave of deaths. And this is what happened in London, Lombardy, Madrid, Geneva, in New York City, Stockholm, many areas around the world. And we just saw that happen in Florida. Florida hit about 20% infected based on serology testing. And then what? Cases began to decline, deaths began to decline. And that's what we've been seeing for the past few weeks. And so it really kind of challenges the idea that we need 60 to 70% infected to reach this herd immunity. And also, T cells can then explain maybe why so many people are asymptomatic, why, you know, in the neighborhood of 50% or maybe even more of people who, you know, test positive for SARS-CoV-2 actually don't have any symptoms. So there could be some, you know, differences between, like we said before, where the PCR tests are kind of too good, or it could be that, and it's probably a combination of the two, that we have T cells that are able to fight off this virus before we even develop symptoms.
You know what's kind of interesting is that older folks don't get colds. And I'm not sure that's a – that I don't know what that is. I'm not sure it's because they have a accumulated immunity. There's something about the immune system as it age. They tend not to get colds, while young people get exuberant colds. And I'm wondering if that exuberance is where they get the leftover T cell function that wanes with age. Isn't that interesting?
Perhaps.
Yeah, it's interesting. Perhaps. Interesting. So did you see the interview on Unheard with the Nobel Prize winner Michael Levitt?
I've been following a good amount of Michael Levitt's content. I don't think I've heard that specific interview.
So I'm sure then. I mean, he has made this case. He also has made the case that we change our behavior, and when things start to pick up, we distance from each other. So it's the 20% number is in the context of also behavior change. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. So there's two arguments. You could say that, you know, behavior changes at the 20%. It does seem like it's very interesting how it's kind of always around that.
Yeah, it's probably some combination, right? It's probably something about like everything in medicine. So let's go back to your fatality rate. We didn't finish that conversation about the 0.2% overall fatality rate. What is the press version of the fatality rate? What is the press telling us is our fatality rate?
I don't know what they're saying these days, but I know when we put out 0.2%, we were attacked pretty aggressively and people told us that we were absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. And then I think the CDC came out shortly thereafter saying that it was about 0.2 to 0.3%. I know the media didn't cover that as much, and the way they talk about this disease, they definitely say it's higher than that. I think they were saying something closer to maybe 1%.
I keep seeing 0.8.
0.8. Okay, sure. Yeah. Something on 0.8.
Yeah.
It's actually interesting now that they are, you know, because I think it's pretty well known the infection fatality rate is, and it's probably going to continue to come out that it's actually much lower than that. Because even if you look at the case fatality rate, if you can call based on PCR or based on the PCR test, the case fatality rate, you know, I just did analysis today where if you in the U.S. the case fatality rate is about 1%. Based on PCR test.
Explain what you mean by case fatality rate.
So case fatality rate is the number of kind of diagnosed cases compared to the number of deaths with COVID-19. Yeah. And whereas that's different from the, say, infectious fatality rate, the IFR, which is the number of people that were infected, many of which weren't hospitalized or maybe didn't even know that they're infected. And so the infection fatality rate is going to be significantly lower generally than the case fatality rate. And so what, you know, we're talking about the case fatality rate is something about 0.1%.
Yeah.
But the infection fatality rate is probably far lower.
Right.
We're probably talking about something that's, you know, in, like I said, 0.1, 0.2%.
So it is more, not hugely, but more fatal than influenza. It is more infectious than influenza. It requires some special attention, let's be fair. But shutting down the world? Is that the attention it needs? And by the way, isolating everyone in the home where the majority of the transmission occurs? it's all upside down, humbly. What do you think?
No, absolutely. I think that so early on in this disease, I don't think it was fully understood. We didn't really know what we were up against. And I'm talking about, January, February, March. But then it became pretty clear to me in April that there's enough evidence now to know how lethal this disease really was. And that's when in my mind, it became like, okay, no, this is something that we can resume life as normal. We don't need a new normal, right. And we can, we'll get through this and we'll be fine. So that's when it changed in my mind.
Right. I could tell I got wrong the exuberance of the cytokine storm and the risk factors to the elderly and the infectivity. I got that all wrong. But the overall panic that the press was trying to induce and the fact that this is not that much worse than influenza, or certainly I was trying to compare, help people understand against H1N1. I could see this coming. I could see it coming in January. And I knew we were going to do something horrible because of panic and not because of the illness.
Yeah, that's what we did.
Yeah.
Which is, really unfortunate. Yeah, absolutely. It was,
And now we have politicized medicine. Now we have therapeutics we could be using, except we can't because the politics has interfered with the doctor-patient relationship. We have massive economic displacement. We have suicide up, depression up, anxiety up, opioids up, opioid overdose up. It's going to and delay in treatment. Every time – I want people to listen to me. Every time you hear your hospitals are full, it's not full of COVID. It's full of people who've been delaying their medical care and now are coming in hot. They're coming in sick. And people are dying because of that. The unintended deaths are going to be just off the chain. And do you ever examine – do you agree with that, first of all? Am I saying anything that you just –
Yes. Agree? Yeah. And yeah. The other thing with hospital, you got to be a little bit careful when they say hospitals are full because sometimes it means that they're just full regarding the staff capacity.
Well, they always. So always they mean
short
that.
Staff.
Here, let me tell you a little secret. Now, ICUs are managed in such a way that they're always at 90%.
Absolutely. I worked in the ICU. It was almost always exactly that.
Always. That's full. The nurse manager.
You have like two extra patients in an ICU and now you're at capacity.
Yeah. No, the nurse managers are punished if they don't keep it at 90%. Staff it. They have 14 beds, but they have staff for 9 beds.
Yep.
That's 100%. That's 100% full now.
Yep.
It's not available beds. It's how what's the percentage of beds that are used right now versus –
Wait. For real, the numbers are based on the number of staff that
always,
are there?
Always.
What? Yeah. How is that?
I'm telling you that we know this. This is our world. This is our profession. You shouldn't have to worry about this. Nobody should be reporting it to you. We know it. We're the ones that make the decisions. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. It makes me crazy. Anyway. I lost my train of thought. James was – I wanted to go back.
See. Infection fatality rates.
No. I wanted to go back to the panic porn, the hospitals, the delay in treatment.
Politicized medicine.
It's not coming back to me, whatever I wanted to talk about. Something that shoot. Well, again, let's talk a little vaccine. Where are you coming in on that?
You know, let's say, if we just take a step back and look at Sweden, okay, and I know it's probably been discussed at length, but, and this kind of ties again into the T-cell immunity argument that there's really a path, I think, for natural immunity. Mm-hmm. And if you look at Sweden, they're down to less than one death per day now. And this is and I just posted
well, in California, that would be unacceptable. We wouldn't be able to open if that was happening in California.
Exactly. One death is too many.
Yeah.
There's a video that I just tweeted today where it shows someone in the subway, which shows kids interacting with each other, kind of hanging out. You don't have any of those little circles on the ground showing you need to be 6 feet apart. You don't have certain seat fillers, making sure you don't sit too close to someone. Sweden, and this is Stockholm, is largely back to normal. They don't have really a new normal. And you're seeing less than one death per day. The number of cases is not skyrocketing. It's kind of staying level over there. And so, a vaccine, could it be helpful? It's possible, but this is a new vaccine. It's a little bit different from the other vaccines. And I don't know if I would jump into vaccinating a whole country, even people who have extremely low risk of dying from this disease, that early, especially with safety data that only goes out, you know, 6 months, 9 months. I think it's something that, you know, usually vaccines, new vaccines take years to develop. The flu vaccine is a little bit different because it's a hodgepodge of kind of the samples that they've taken. They've been doing the same approach for, you know, many years, but this is a new vaccine. And I don't think that I would really just jump into to getting it for something that has an infection
fatality rate of 0.2%. I understand it. I get that. And if you have concerns, you might want to use get one of the vaccines that is a more traditional protein or attenuated virus, that kind of thing. I personally have signed up for 4 phase 3 trials because I've looked at the biology. It looks very safe to me, and I want to help push this thing forward. And B, and this is the reason I'm going to take the vaccine, I'm sick and fucking tired of all this. I want to move about the country.
You'll do whatever it takes at this point.
Yes. And so – but no one has asked me to come on these trials, so I'm sure I will be part of the November distribution, and I will happily take it. I'd prefer to take, again, a more traditional vaccine than the RNA or the DNA vaccines, but I'll take them. The biology looks amazing on those. They're just amazing technologies. Yeah, so I get it. And I don't think the government should be mandating, frankly, anything. It's all overreach. They should not be mandating masks. They should be not mandating vaccines. They should not be 100%. Mandating the prevention of hydroxychloroquine. This has nothing to do with the government. This is your and my profession doing our thing, what we do. We have the CDC. I've been following Dr. Fauci for 35 years. He's never let me down. And that's it. We just do what we know how to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I get asked about masks all the time. And it's always, look, if you feel like you need a mask, if you feel like you're vulnerable, then wear a
mask. I like the mask because you can kind of see the proof is in the pudding. I mean, you can see when people start wearing masks diligently, you see the cases go down. And we have a Gestapo in California. We have to do something here, James. And so we're going to have to all get together and wear the damn masks to get ourselves out of this concentration camp we're in. So I sort of feel like, please, everybody, let's kind of get with it just because we're seeing the thing decline, at least until the vaccine comes out, and let's all get the vaccine if you feel up to it. So it's interesting to me that there's not one thing we even mildly disagree on, which is kind of unusual in medicine or in biology. You know, usually we'll have sort of things around the margins that we disagree about, but I can't think of one thing you and I disagree about.
Well, I think it's because we have a lot of evidence that's coming out now. So if you actually look at the evidence, you know, you can, you know, using scientific, you know, based approaches, you can kind of come to.
Wait a minute. Hold a second. I mean, there's such a thing as the truth? I'm shocked.
Maybe. You know, I would say back in February, you probably would have disagreed. I mean, we certainly would have disagreed on some things. But that was because there wasn't enough evidence yet.
Well, we wouldn't have been using such certainty in our language either. We would have been going, I think it looks like, you know, whatever. Gary, go ahead.
So I just – in an attempt to further the conversation a little bit, are there doctors out there that you respect that do disagree with you, and where?
Good question. Well, I don't know where they are. I know there's a lot of weirdness around hydroxychloroquine, and it just looks politically motivated to me. Dr. Zelenko says it's motivated by profit, you know, for the pharmaceutical companies. It's weird to me. It's just weird. Why wouldn't you want to look at the studies, get more studies, and make your conclusion? And to have any energy with it is weird to me. Beyond that, it seems like a consensus is growing, which is, again, always the way it works. Where do you see pushback, James?
There's a pushback on a number of fronts, but I think it kind of comes a little bit, you know, a lot of physicians, and I think we have this training in residency where whatever our training is in, we're not really allowed to think about any specialties or any aspects of medicine outside of that. And that's different for maybe family practice doctors and maybe emergency medicine. But like, for instance, ophthalmology, it was like, oh, you don't think about anything else. If you want, you know, if a patient asks if they should take a vitamin, it's like, well, you should talk to your family practice doctor.
Listen, you had the same training I had. You're probably a biologist by training to begin with, or certainly you've had plenty of that. You and I know who got into ophthalmology residencies, not the dummies. So I want your good mind helping us.
Well, right. So my point is that so many people, so many physicians won't actually think about this disease. Mm. So unless they're specifically an infectious disease physician or maybe an epidemiologist, if they're talking about the epidemiology of the disease, they will say, they'll just kind of refer to whatever they're seeing on mainstream media, whatever their whoever is their trusted source.
Right.
Which, you know, I think that for, just like you said, and which is why I feel comfortable talking about the infectious disease component of this, the immunology perspective aspect of it, is because, you know, it's all evidence. It's still reading, ability to read evidence.
Yeah.
What we're trained to do in medical school and residency.
Yep.
And so I feel comfortable doing that. Yep. So many physicians will sit there and say, and other physicians will tell me, they're like, well, you're an ophthalmologist. This isn't your specialty. And I was like, I know how to read evidence, though. That's what we're talking about here.
We know good versus not good scientific papers. We know whether or not the evidence is something that looks like something we can rely upon. We know how we look towards reproduction of that data. We just know how to assess it. That's all we did during residency. It was just assess papers.
Right. And there was that training that helped, like, you know, detect the Lancet study was fraudulent.
Yeah.
The data didn't make sense. And then when you dug into Surgisphere, it absolutely didn't make sense. But yeah, so when you say, do other doctors disagree? Yeah, there's plenty of doctors that disagree with me on hydroxychloroquine, on the long-term effects of this disease, on whether we should be open up. But I think it's because they're not really actually thinking critically about this, not doing their own research. It's just relying on whatever kind of channel they're listening to.
And you know, in our world, it's good to have, you know, some pushback and discourse and stuff like that. But that we want that. It helps us think through our positions more carefully. And we can turn out to be wrong sometimes. That happens a lot. But the weird energy and shit slinging that goes with it now is just beyond otherworldly. It's very,
well, that,
very, very
and
strange.
Even the, you know, a step further, the censorship we're seeing on numerous levels. I mean, if you forget about social media platforms, the censorship on there, which I'm sure you heard, I was part of the frontline doctors, you know, the White Coat Summit back in D.C. A few weeks ago, and you know that was censored across all social media platforms. But you're even seeing it now at the level of academic journals. There are a number of immunologists, biomathematicians, infectious disease experts that are trying to publish their own research on this pandemic. But if it doesn't fit the mainstream narrative, they're not being published. Which is, and a biomathematician actually put out a great article that looked at, you know, basically what I was saying, which, why are we seeing these infectious, you know, the infections hit about 20% in decline. It was a great mathematical model explaining that. And she tweeted out a exact response, a quote from the journal, why it was rejected. And it was basically, well, we think it's dangerous to put out this information that the herd immunity threshold might be lower than 60-70%. So that's why we're not publishing this. This should not be happening, especially in journals. That's where you have an open evidence-based approach. It's you're really going back to like the Stalin era, and when you're talking about suppressing science, because it's dangerous.
Right. This is Stalinistic. It's Maoist. Yeah. It's weird. It's so weird. It's weird. Well, I appreciate you speaking out, and it's good to talk to you. We'll see. You know how this all goes. I think we're certainly getting into a better phase right now. I don't expect another peak following this, particularly with a vaccine on the horizon. But I think it's a virus we're going to be living with for a long time.
I think that too. I think that this idea of completely eradicating it is a little bit silly. I think that the most vulnerable people.
Well, so here's something you don't deal with as an ophthalmologist, which is death and dying and aging so much. I mean, I know you're taking a lot of cataracts out and that kind of thing, but as an internist, that's all we deal with. And I'm here to tell you, I would never be a patient in a nursing home. So if I am so far gone that I need chronic care in a nursing home, palliate. Get me hospice, get me something, and let's call it a day. Everybody needs to have these conversations with themselves, with their parents. You will be surprised how many people don't want to live in misery or dementia or debilitated and non-functional. They don't want it. And if there's no chance of coming back, a lot of people would like something, let's call it conservative, which is like a hospice type thing. And I am one of those people. I, if you put me in a nursing home, I will come haunt you. I will come haunt you when a time comes. let me go. And you got to understand something. You keep talking about the most vulnerable. Do you know what the average length of stay is in a nursing home?
No, I don't.
After admission, it's in dementia units, it's six.
Sure.
It's 6 months.
Yeah.
So how much life are we preserving here? Even for a general nursing home unit, it's 6 to 24 months, depending on what data you're looking at. So you're saving at max 2 years of misery. What do we do? Now, if somebody really, really wants that, they should get it. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying people should not have access to it. And it should be done in a high, high, high quality way if that's what people want. I'm telling you, it's not for me. And I am not alone.
Didn't we kind of see a response to that, though, when we saw this kind of started ripping through nursing homes? It seemed like a lot of kids started pulling their parents out of nursing homes.
Yeah.
And they were, getting out. So, the ones that, that could get out kind of naturally solved itself to some degree. Of course, people were taken by surprise.
Well, the other thing that I'm hearing now increasingly from elderly people is, as this thing has dragged on, it's like, hey, I'm 75 years of age. I'm a male. My life expectancy is another 8 years. You want to take a year away from me and from seeing my grandkids? I could die just of being 75. I could die at 77, and now you've taken half of my remaining time. So a 0.8% chance of dying of an illness and 100% chance of losing 10% of my remaining days. Best case. Older people
are something that everyone has to carefully weigh. It's not a freebie. You're not giving up. You're giving up living your life. And my grandparents are the same way. My grandfather's in his 90s, and he's like, well, I look forward to kind of getting to see everyone more frequently after this pandemic's over. And you gotta weigh that a little bit. Like, he's super healthy. He's great. He probably would actually survive it. He'd be fine. He got it. No. But that's something that there's a real cost here. It's not a freebie.
It's a real, real serious cost. It's a human cost. It's a spiritual cost. It's an interpersonal cost. And I'm here to tell you, ask these elderly people if they want to pay that price up front or take a risk on the backside that they contract this thing. And by the way, and personally, we didn't discuss masks, but masks work. They mitigate the risk. Wear the mask. Keep a distance. Do sensible things. But you may not want at the age of 78 to cash in a huge piece of your remaining time in the name of what?
It's risk management. Like, if you're 80, you're going to go out to a concert or go to, probably not. Maybe you don't do that.
Right.
But if you're talking about hanging out with your grandkids, hugging your family, maybe that's okay.
Yeah, we wear a mask, have them tested the week before. There's all kinds of ways to manage it. So.
Yeah.
Listen, this has been a fun conversation, and I appreciate you speaking out. I appreciate the research you've done, and I appreciate you coming on today. We are Twitter pals now. I just got you. And also medicineuncensored.com. Twitter is James Todaro, TODARO MD. And any place else you want to send people?
That's just about it.
Anything coming that we should look forward to in the near term?
I'm going to be putting out some content on the kind of case fatality rates, I think, over the next couple of days. But
I know the last thing I wanted to talk to you about was the excess mortality relative to our usual – the monthly mortality that we always have. Have you looked at any of that data?
I have. So there does seem to be an uptick in deaths if you average out the first 32, 33 weeks of the year, if you compare – the average for 2017, 2018, 2019 to 2020, there does seem to be an uptick. So I don't think we can sit there and say,
again, I'm back to Dr. Levitt's stuff. He looks at that cycle as having concluded. Like, we're through it. We're through the excess
right.
deaths.
So if you look at the last, let's say, 10 weeks, it's pretty much over. We're kind of trending back to standard levels. Yeah. They actually put out a chart a couple of weeks ago that shows that in Europe, The you're more likely to die of suicide. Suicide rates are higher now than COVID deaths over there.
Yeah. We're heading there.
Comparable to obvious heart disease.
We'll get there.
Yep.
All right. Thank you so much. We'll talk again soon.
All right. Sounds good.
See you all next time.
For calling times and topics, follow the show on Twitter at Dr. Drew Podcast. That's DRDREW Podcast. The music from today's episode can be found on the swinging sounds of the Dr. Drew Podcast, now available on iTunes. And while you're there, don't forget to rate the show. The Dr. Drew Podcast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana and Gary Smith. For more information, go to drdrew.com. All conversation and information exchanged during the participation in the Dr. Drew Podcast is intended for educational and entertainment purposes only. Do not confuse this with treatment or medical advice or direction. Nothing on these podcasts supplement or supersede the relationship and direction of your medical caretakers. Although Dr. Drew is a licensed physician with specialty board certifications by the American Board of Internal Medicine and the American Board of Addiction Medicine, he is not functioning as a physician in this environment. The same applies to any professionals who may appear on the podcast or drdrew.com.
Get ultimate protection and durability for your painting project at Menards. Get a paint that combines durability and gorgeous color. Dutch Boy's DuraClean Interior Paint and Primer in One offers Stay Clean technology, making your home stay beautiful and clean longer. And with Dutch Boy's easy opening, smooth pouring container, transforming your home has never been easier. Save big money on Dutch Boy paints and head into Menards to get your paint project started today. Save